puts her arms around me.
I'm going to miss you,
she says. She begins to sob in my arms, keening. Shh, I pat her back. It's all right, dear. Holding her, I feel myself soften. I can't remember anyone holding me like this since Tom. It brings tears to my own eyes. I'm not going to do it, Lucy, I whisper into her ear. Lucy stills, but remains where she is for a moment. When she finally lifts her head, I feel a surprising sense of loss, a coldness where her warm head had just been.
Really?
I can't leave Nettie with everything that's going on right now, I say. I can't leave Ollie and my grandchildren. I can't leave my charity. Lucy's hair has gone all static, fanning around her face like a mane. I pat it down, tuck it behind her ears. And I can't leave you, Luce. Before I can finish, Lucy throws her arms around me again with such force that it takes my breath away.
I love you, Diana,
she says. I smile. I love you too. And then we stand there in the center of the room, holding each other and crying. Chapter 57. Diana. The past. They say little boys love their mothers, and I think there is something to it. Little girls love their mothers too, of course, but a little boy's love for his mother is pure, untainted. Boys see their mothers in the most primal way, a protector, devotee, a disciple. Sons bask in their mother's love rather than questioning it or testing it. What I like best about the mother-son relationship is the simplicity of it. When Ollie was a toddler, when times were really tight, I had fleeting pangs of guilt that I wasn't able to give him things. I remember asking him what he wanted for his birthday, and he replied,
I'd like to go to the beach and then eat Vegemite sandwiches for dinner.
It was, perhaps, the only thing we could afford. For a moment, I thought that's why he'd said it. But then I realized he was too young for that. Sandwiches at the beach was simply his idea of a perfect day. So today, when Ollie calls to suggest a visit, I don't read into it. I expect that's all he wants, a visit. Ollie is committed to Lucy and his family comes first, but I like to think there's still a part of his heart that is reserved for his dear old mum. But when he appears at the door, it is immediately apparent that he is not, in fact, here for a visit. He looks upset, and he doesn't try to hide it. He is in his work clothes but looks scruffy, as if he slept at the office. What is it, darling? I ask him. He closes his eyes, shakes his head. Can we talk inside? We go into the den, and Ollie declines my offer for tea or coffee. Instead, he drops onto the sofa. I sit opposite him, and his face drops into my lap. I put a hand into the thick, dark hair he didn't get from me or Tom, and run my fingers through it like I used to when he was a little boy. Now he is a 48-year-old little boy. What is it? I repeat. My business is going under. We're not going to make our loan repayment, he says, and the bank is calling in our debt. My hand freezes in his hair. Oh no, Ollie, I had no idea. Honestly, neither did I. I've been working my ass off for this business for years and I can't seem to make any headway. I honestly don't know where the money goes. Probably into Eamon's pocket, I mutter. I've never thought of it before, but suddenly it seems like the obvious answer. Ollie stares at me. I might be wrong, I say, but I'm betting I'm not. Ollie blinks into the middle distance, perhaps processing this. Then he sits up. No. Eamon wouldn't. Wouldn't what? Go to any length to line his pockets? Ollie shakes his head. God, I don't know. I haven't even spoken to him properly in months. Have you tried? Course I have. He says everything is fine and we can talk later. You need to insist. He laughs blackly. Even if I did, Mum, there's nothing to talk about now. It's over. The business is worthless. He presses his fingers into his eye sockets. I've never seen him look more broken. Not if you make your loan payment, I say after a moment or two. Ollie frowns. But how? I might be able to come on board as a silent partner. At least I might if Eamon had nothing to do with it. As a matter of fact, I have an idea for your business. It would be a bit of a departure from what you're doing now.
What kind of departure?
When I tell Ollie my idea, he looks so surprised and impressed, I have to try hard not to be offended. That's right, I want to say. Your father wasn't the only one with business ideas. He rests his chin in his hand, taking it all in. And he reminds me so much of Tom, I find it impossible to believe they weren't biologically related. We live on, I realize. We live on through our children.
You know what? He says finally. That is a business I could really throw myself into.
Chapter 58. Lucy. The present. The phone is ringing in the background again. The darn thing won't stop. But neither Ollie nor I look at it or even acknowledge it. You asked Diana for money? For your business?
Yes.
Why didn't you tell me? Ollie pinches the top of his nose between his thumb and forefinger.
You said it was a deal breaker.
I blink at him. What? A deal breaker, you said that. If I ever asked Mum for money, I couldn't lose you on top of everything else. I sigh. Jesus, Ollie, you're not going to lose me. I close my eyes.
The weirdest thing was that she agreed, he says. I never expected her to.
Then why did you ask?
I don't know, maybe I just wanted to talk to my mum. You probably won't believe this, but she could be very wise.
I chuckle a little. Actually, I do believe that. The landline phone stops ringing, and for a moment we are surrounded by pure silence. But it lasts only a second or two before Ollie's mobile starts up. I open my eyes. I want to throw it against the wall.
She was different, Ollie says, frowning as if recalling it. She didn't tell me to make my own way or to figure it out myself. She told me she had my back. She said we'd pay off Eamon and go into business together.
She wanted to go into business with you?
She had a really interesting idea, actually. A recruitment agency for highly skilled refugees. Engineers, doctors, IT professionals, a full-service agency that helped to get candidates' qualifications recognised in Australia and giving them all the tools they needed to transition into good jobs across all fields. It was a really good idea. She thought you might want to be involved too.
She did?
A family business, she said.
Ollie's chin puckers.
But then she killed herself. Why would she say all of that and then kill herself less than an hour later?
Obviously, I have no idea. When Diana told me she'd changed her mind about killing herself, I'd believed her. Why would she say that if it wasn't true? And even if she had changed her mind back again, it didn't explain the letter in the drawer or the thread in her hands. It didn't explain the missing pillow. There's only one explanation I can think of, I say to Ollie. Someone must have gotten there after you left.
Chapter 59. Diana. The past. After Ollie leaves, I go to Tom's study and pull out my letter. I look down at it. I could have written more, but in the end, there's really only two pieces of wisdom worth leaving behind. I worked hard for everything I ever cared about, and nothing I ever cared about cost a single cent. Mum. I've never been a woman of many words. I could have crafted a letter to my children explaining why I'd chosen to end my life or about how much I loved them, but that wasn't my style. Besides, how would it help them? Sentiment had a way of diluting truth, and if I was going to leave a last few words of wisdom for my children, I wanted them to be clear. Now, of course, I won't be needing any letter. At first, I think about burning it. Then I wonder if I should keep it as a reminder of how I felt this past year. Perhaps it's a good thing to remember. I tuck the letter into the office drawer and head down the stairs, and am just walking past the front room when Nettie lets herself in. "Hi, Mum," she says. "Can we talk?" Nettie walks into the small front room. I follow her, sit beside her. She picks up one of the cushions and begins fiddling with the gold tassels nervously. "I'm here about the money, obviously," she says, not wasting any time on small talk. "For the surrogacy. I've been talking to the agency and I'm going to need to pay the deposit soon. I'm sorry to pressure you, but this is my
last chance."
"Yes."
My mind drifts to Patrick, his flashing eyes. She's on a mission for a baby. She's obsessed by it. It's like she's possessed.
"And Patrick is on board?" I ask lightly. "About the surrogacy?" "Of course."
She avoids my gaze, the way she did when she was little and didn't want to talk about something.
"Of course he is."
"How are things with Patrick, Nettie?" I ask. "Is your relationship solid?" She shrugs.
"Sure it is."
"Really?" Nettie looks up, takes in my skeptical expression and becomes guarded.
"What?"
She sounds almost angry.
"You know Patrick has been unfaithful, don't you?" I say.
"You must know, Antoinette." The expression on Nettie's face, a kind of bewildered rage, is so jarring that for a moment I wonder if it's possible that she doesn't know. Then she laughs.
"Of course I know. Everyone knows."
I hesitate a moment, thrown by the bizarre laugh, but decide to plow on. If I'm going to help my daughter, I need to understand her, see her side of things.
"Then why would you want to bring a baby into a relationship like that? Tell me, darling."
She rolls her eyes.
"It's not about Patrick, don't you see that? It's about me."
Nettie stands up, starts pacing. She goes back and forth several times.
"Nettie, I'm worried about you," I say. "You're not in a fit state to go into surrogacy. I think you need to see someone, get some professional help."
Her pacing stops abruptly. Her eyes lock on mine.
"Does this mean you won't help me?"
"It depends what you mean by help. I'll help you find a psychologist to speak to. I'll help support you if you decide to leave Patrick, and I'll help support you if you decide to stay with him. But I won't be funding your egg donor and surrogate plan, no. Not right now." Nettie hovers over me, her hands shaking with rage. She shifts from foot to foot in front of me. I remain still, as if trying not to spook a frightened animal.
"Do you have any idea what it's like to have the one thing you want taken away from you?"
Her voice grows in volume and intensity as she speaks.
"Yes, Tom was taken away from me." "Did it make you question your own life, your purpose?"
"It did."
"I don't believe you. If you knew what I was talking about, you would never do this to me."
"Believe me, Nettie, I know," I say.
"I understand what it's like to feel that your entire purpose is wrapped up in one thing, one person."
I hadn't intended to tell Nettie about my planned suicide, but suddenly it feels like the one thing that might bring her to her senses.
"After your father died, I contemplated suicide. I researched it. I bought poison online. It's still in the door of the damn fridge. But it was madness, the whole thing. I loved Tom, but he wasn't my entire life. I have you and Ollie and Lucy. I have my grandchildren, my friends, my charity. And Nettie, you may not see it now, but your life isn't about having a baby."
I stand so we are eye to eye.
Forget about babies. Take your life in a different direction. You could do anything you want.
So you won't give me the money?
She says when I'm finished.
Nettie, have you heard anything I've said?
Nettie turns her back to me, and for a moment there is total silence. But after a few seconds, a curious noise begins, thin and reedy like the ragged edge of a tin can. It takes me a moment to realize the noise is coming from Nettie. I reach for her shoulder, but before I grasp it, she spins around and lunges at me like a force. Her elbow catches my nose and I careen backward, landing hard on my tailbone. As I cry out, Nettie appears over me, gripping the cushion so tight the veins in her hands pop out.
Nettie, darling!
I fall silent. The expression on her face is pure and unadulterated hate. I think of Ollie's visit a few minutes ago, and I see the juxtaposition suddenly of sons and daughters. Sons see the best parts of you, but daughters really see you. They see your flaws and your weaknesses. They see everything they don't want to be. They see you for exactly who you are, and they hate you for it.
This is over, Mum,
Nettie says, and I'm not sure what she means until she presses the pillow into my face and holds it there with a resolve that tells me she is not letting go. I feel her weight on my chest. I grab hold of her wrists and squeeze hard, but she just pushes the pillow harder into my face. I can't take a breath. My lungs burn. And as the edges fade to black, I think to myself, she got that resolve from me.
Chapter 60. Nettie. The past.
Mum's legs stopped moving first. She didn't go down without a fight, but that was classic Mum. And it worked in my favour. Each kick had only served to tire her out faster. Now I sit astride her chest, the same way Ollie used to sit on me when I was a kid and he wanted to interrogate me for snooping in his bedroom. Slowly, her vice-like grip on my wrists weakens until she lets go entirely. But I keep holding the pillow down until she's been still for several minutes. Finally, I stand, leaving the pillow over her face. Mum is dead. Her legs have fallen to the sides so her shoes point in opposite directions. Looking at them, I'm reminded of the Wicked Witch of the East when Dorothy's house falls on her. Mum took me to see The Wizard of Oz at the Grand Theatre for my 9th birthday and even gave me a pair of ruby slippers to wear as a present. I missed most of the show because I was admiring the way my footwear sparkled in the theatre lights. I wore those slippers every day after until the soles were thin as paper and I could feel the rocks and dirt under my feet. It was one of only a handful of times that Mum had gotten it right with me. My brain wades through all the information at hand as I try to figure out what to do next. Mum's left arm is bent up over her head. Her nails are painted an awful flesh-coloured pink, and on her ring finger is her cluster of rings, all modest yellow gold. I've never seen her without those rings. They are like a bizarre knuckle, a living part of her. Or now, a dead part of her. I'm slowly becoming aware of the trouble I'm in. I killed my mother. Killed her, as they said in the movies, with my bare hands. And yet as I look down at her, so still and quiet, all I feel is peace. Not the untethered, free-falling terror I felt when Dad died. Peace. It's funny. In theory, a mother and a father do the same thing. They nurture you, protect you, try to form you into a reasonable human being. If they do it right, they will keep your feet on the ground. If they do it wrong, they'll stop you from flying. The difference is subtle, yet vast. For me, it was Dad's way that gave me life. Dad. His name pops into my mouth and I breathe it out. It occurs to me that it's the first time I've had a problem, a real problem, and he hasn't been here for me.
"It is just a problem, Antoinette," he would probably have said. "And a problem is only a problem until you solve it."
I massage my right wrist gently, then my left.
For someone so skinny, Mum was surprisingly strong and determined.
After your father died, I contemplated suicide. I researched it. I bought poison online. It's still in the door of the damn fridge.
She had said that, hadn't she? Or had I imagined it?
I walk to the kitchen and hold the fridge door open with my hip. A half-empty carton of milk is wedged in beside an unopened bottle of tonic water and two brown glass bottles with white labels covered in medical gibberish. I squat down to examine the labels. In square green and red letters, the name Letubin is spelled out. An idea starts to form in my mind. I slide my hands into a pair of washing-up gloves and carry both bottles back into the front room. When I remove the pillow from Mum's face, I only look at her long enough to see that she doesn't look serene. Her face is frozen in a haunting grimace, an angry, bitter cry. I put down one of the bottles and remove the lid of the other, and I focus on tipping the contents into her mouth. Most of it spills down her cheeks and collects in her mouth, so I tip the last of it into the fireplace and leave the empty bottle beside her limp hand. There doesn't seem to be a lot of point in using the other, so I shove it into my handbag. It's not a great plan, but it's all I've got. As I turn to leave, I rub my wrists. They're going to be bruised tomorrow.
Chapter 61. Lucy. The present. Ollie's phone stops ringing, finally. But when my phone starts to ring immediately afterward, it sends an odd alert through me.
"We should answer that," I say.
Ollie nods as if he's just realized the same thing. My phone is next to him on the couch, and he presses it to his ear.
"Hello? Yes?"
His eyes find mine.
"What do you mean?"
His eyebrows shoot skyward.
"No."
"What is it?" I ask,
but Ollie holds a palm up.
"Are you sure?"
he says into the phone, and then he is silent for the longest time. I can't tell if he's listening or processing or what. His eyes close, hard. His face crumples. I don't dare speak. I hardly dare to breathe.
"Yes," he says after an eternity. "Okay, we'll be right there."
"What is it?"
I ask when he hangs up the phone.
"It's Nettie," he says. "She's dead."
Chapter 62. Nettie. The past. Who are we after we're gone, I wonder? It's a good question to ponder. Most people can't come up with an answer right away. They frown, consider it for a minute, maybe even sleep on it. Then the answers start to come. We're our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. We're all the people who will go on to live because we lived. We are our wisdom, our intellect, our beauty, filtered through generations, continuing to spill into the world and make a difference. Most people end up with some version of this. Then they will nod, satisfied and secure in their contribution, certain that their lives will not be void of meaning. Of course, there are plenty of ways to give your life meaning beyond having children. Everyone says this. Some people believe it. But in the end, it doesn't matter because I don't believe it. And this is, after all, my life. The problem is, Patrick came home at exactly the wrong time. I was sitting up in bed in my pajamas. After extensive Googling to ensure that one bottle of Letubin would be enough to kill me, I'd poured it into a coffee mug. It was on my bedside table. On my lap was a notepad and a pen. I had just put pen to paper when I saw Patrick's car pull into the driveway. I planned to write a note, explaining everything to Patrick, absolving him from blame and guilt and responsibility. I wanted to give him that. Even after all that's happened, I had affection for Patrick. He tried his best. If I had only become pregnant easily, Patrick and I would probably still have been happy. People underestimate the role fate plays in our lives. Silly them.
and so when I see his car, I lift the mug to my lips and drink it down in one almighty gulp. Then I lie back and close my eyes. I'm out.
Chapter 63. Lucy. The present. Dad arrives early on the morning of Nettie's funeral with a bag of donuts for the kids. He stays to help Ollie and I as we roll about the house like marbles, searching for missing socks and neckties for Archie, who now, he tells us, has a funeral uniform. The photographers are outside again today. They'd arrived 2 days after Nettie's death, when the whole twisted story had hit the press. Money, greed, and family. Inside the society family murder-suicide. The article didn't have much in the way of facts, but the police had warned us that more would likely come out. There was something about the uber-wealthy falling from grace. People were insatiable for information, and the more sordid the better. The police had also warned us that photographers would almost certainly be outside the funeral, trying to get a shot of us crying. Yesterday, Harriet had given the photographer the peace sign and trout-pout lips as she hoofed her way out to the car. It was probably today's cover story, but I didn't have the heart to look.
"How are you holding up?" Dad asks me.
I am ironing Edie's only clean dress. She will have to wear it with odd socks because I can't find a pair that match. In light of everything else that's happened, I can't find a reason to care.
"Honestly, I feel like nothing will ever be the same."
"It doesn't last forever, honey."
I look up from the ironing board, blinking back the tears that come to my eyes with such ease these days.
"How do you know?"
I ask. A childish question, but then again, he is my dad.
"I know because I've been there."
Even as an adult, it's easy to forget that your parents are people. Now it occurs to me that of course he's been there. My mother's death had come right on the heels of Dad's mother, my Nana. It's not something I'd thought much about back then. After all, my dad had been a grown-up and I was just a kid. And Nana, as far as I was concerned, had been old, 61. But it was only a year later, almost to the day, when Papa, Dad's dad, dropped dead of a heart attack. He had been 67. It was a lot of people to lose in just over a year. I put down the iron.
"How long does it last?"
He offers me a sad smile.
"It lasts a while."
"Mom," Harriet calls. "Archie's watching the iPad."
"I'll go," Dad says.
The kids are sad about Aunt Nettie's death. All of them have cried multiple times, even Edie. But their grief is wonderfully fickle. Here one moment, gone the next. This, too, I'm becoming familiar with.
"How do I look?"
Ollie says. He stands in the doorway of the laundry room in what I think of as his Amon suit. It's tight-fitting, navy blue. A recruitment suit. He looks handsome in it.
"I'm going to sell it tomorrow," he says, "on eBay."
There's no point in telling him not to worry about it now, or that we could talk about it in a week or two. Ever since Nettie's death, Ollie has been on a mission to do anything he can to make money, save money, or reclaim money. We've sold our watches, all of my jewelry, a handful of other items that have value. It's got a frenzied avoidance of grief type feel to it, but at the same time I find myself comforted by it, as though he's recommitting to his role in the family, showing us the kind of person he wants to be.
"Actually, there's a Facebook page for people who want to buy second-hand Hugo Boss suits," I say. "You'd probably get a better price for it. I can post it on there if you like."
"That would be great," he says. "Or just tell me the site and I'll do it."
I would be hard-pressed to find an upside to the whole tragedy of Nettie's death, but if I was really trying, I'd say it was the new harmony between Ollie and me. Somehow we have found ourselves perfectly aligned on the goals of our family, and we are absolute partners. It never suited Ollie being the full-time breadwinner, and the funny thing was I always knew that. Now,
working as a team, I realize we are playing to our strengths again. I don't know what is going to happen tomorrow after this funeral. I don't know if we can afford to keep our house. I have no idea what's ahead for us. I know it's likely to be bad for a while, but I'm hoping it won't be bad forever. It's nearly time to go, I say. I turn off the iron and peel Edie's dress off the ironing board. Ollie appears right beside me and gently tugs at my necklace. That was Mum's, wasn't it? I nod. I'd been wearing it every day since Diana died. Ollie turns it over in his fingers. I remember seeing it around Mum's neck when I was little. She said it symbolized strength. We both look down at it. It's a shame she didn't give it to Nettie. We're quiet for a moment, staring down at the necklace. Then Ollie lets it fall back to my chest. Maybe she knew Nettie wasn't strong enough to wear it. Chapter 64. Lucy. 10 years later.
Lucy, Abdul Javid is here for his interview. Is Ollie here?
I glance at my watch.
He must be running late, Gazella. I'll come out. Okay, I'm going home now. Have a good evening.
I hang up the phone and pull on my suit jacket. When I don't have interviews on, I often wear leggings and a t-shirt around the office, part of the perks of running your own business. But today, Ollie and I have had back-to-back interviews all day. Our office is a short drive from our home, in a run-down old townhouse not far from where Gazella used to live. A lot of new refugees settle in this area, which makes it convenient for them and cheap for us. Ollie and I each have offices, formerly bedrooms, and Gazella's office is in the old living room. On the days Gazella comes in, she brings in food for us to share in the living room. She has a playpen set up as well, for those days her youngest isn't in daycare. Gazella has 5 children now. Hakem is making enough money that she doesn't need to work anymore, but as well as being on the board of Diana's charity, she comes in to help us all the time. Translating, making the candidates comfortable, helping explain cultural differences. She was the one who approached us a few months after Diana's death. She'd heard about the business we wanted to start, and she was aware of a sizable pool of money that Diana had bequeathed that was designated for ventures deemed by the board to be in the interests of the charity. Our business fits this criteria. I step into the hallway and shake the hand of a very tall man, his skin as black as burnt wood.
Mr. Javid, I say.
Mrs. Goodwin?
Please, call me Lucy.
Then you must call me Abdul.
Abdul smiles a brilliant white smile. Apart from the trouser legs of his suit, which are several inches too short, he is very presentable. Abdul was a project manager for a major construction group in Afghanistan. He arrived in Australia 4 months ago and has been working as a night cleaner at the local hospital while trying to find work.
Come in, Abdul. Ollie, my partner, will join us in a moment.
Did someone say my name?
Ollie clambers through the back door, dressed in a shirt with jeans. The days of his shiny, tight suits are long gone. Now, Ollie does a lot of his interviews via Skype, so he can be found dressed smartly from the waist up and wearing God knows what from the waist down. He works hard, harder even than he did for Eamon. He is always running late, his paperwork is never done, but he's also more alive than I've ever seen him. He spends hours with the candidates, doing whatever it takes to get them ready for an interview. I do most of the work with our organizations, finding jobs where there aren't any and opening the minds of decision makers at big companies, making them take on someone who perhaps doesn't fit their ideal.
Just give them an interview, has become my catch cry. One interview.
More often than not, that one interview gets our client the job. Like Ollie, I live for that now. As a team, we've become passionate about making sure everyone gets a go. I like to think that we get that from Diana, and that she would be proud of us.
Ollie and Eamon's business declared bankruptcy shortly after Diana's death. Eamon was investigated for misappropriating company funds and was found guilty of fraud. Ollie never regained any of the money Eamon had stolen from him, but he had taken some satisfaction from the fact that Eamon spent 6 months in prison, and that Eamon's young girlfriend Bella had left him for an Iron Man, and last we heard they were writing a paleo cookbook together. We take a seat at the round table, and Abdul tells us about his time in Australia. He explains the difficulties he's had finding work. Some has to do with his English, and Ollie jumps in to say that we'll help him with that.
"We can help you with anything," he says. "English lessons, intercultural relations, mentoring."
After Nettie's death, Ollie threw himself into the business with such vigour I wondered if it was healthy. He'd lost his parents and his sister all within a year, and he needed to heal. It took me a while to see how healing this business actually was for him. We don't see Patrick anymore. We sent Christmas cards for the first couple of years, but once he remarried, apparently to a woman who is the heiress to a very nice fortune stemming from her late father's packaging business, and became the father of twin boys, we let the contact drop. Ollie still found it especially difficult.
"It's not fair. All Nettie wanted was to be a mother. If she hadn't had fertility issues, she and Mum would still be alive."
Maybe that was true. Maybe it wasn't. The fact was, the kids and I were his family, and honestly, being around each other all day long, it had never felt more true. "Okay," I say to Abdul, "why don't you tell us a little about yourself?" The agency has been a huge success in terms of the candidates we've been able to place, particularly with organisations that formerly would never have looked at candidates without Australian experience. And yet, we may never again own a house. We live in a rental not far from our office, near the industrial part of town. The kids' school is rough, diverse, and wonderful, with people from all walks of life. Every day after school, the kids are here at the office doing their homework or playing with Gazella's kids. Diana would have loved every bit of it, and how Tom would have been befuddled. I think that is what fuels Ollie's drive for the whole thing. Everyone, no matter how old they are, wants their mother's approval. And everyone, no matter who they are, wants their mother-in-law's. I glance up at Diana's final letter. Once the investigation into Diana's death was over, the police had handed it over to us. Now, it was framed on the wall of my office, one of my most cherished possessions. I could have written more, but in the end, there's really only two pieces of wisdom worth leaving behind. I worked hard for everything I ever cared about, and nothing I ever cared about cost a single cent. Mum. Such lessons are hard learned, but now we've learned them.
Now listen to an interview with the author.
All right, so hi, I'm Barry Krynick, and I am lucky enough to be here today with author Sally Hepworth, whose books I have been privileged to narrate, three of the four so far, I think. So, hi, it's so nice to finally meet you.
Hi, it's so nice to meet you too.
I understand that you did a number of different jobs before you became a professional writer. So did you always know that you wanted to be a writer? And how did you kind of make that transition?
Yeah, gosh, I did always know that I wanted to be a writer. I wrote my first book when I was 7 years old. It was a book of short stories. And I told my mum to publish it, and she put it in a manila folder and bound it and told me it was published, and I believed her for a really long time.
Oh, that's cute.
But it wasn't until I was 29 and I was pregnant with my first child that I had decided to actually sit down and try to write a book that will actually get published. Before that, I worked in event management for a few years, really fun job organising music festivals around Australia. And then I moved over to Canada, where I retrained and became an HR professional for 3 years. And then that brought me up to when I started writing my book. And that was because I was about to go on maternity leave, and the Canadians pay for a year of maternity leave. They're very forward like that, the Canadians. And I thought I was going to need something to do with all my spare time on maternity leave. But in fact, there wasn't that much spare time.
Not with a tiny baby, I would imagine.
But I did write a book that year, and I couldn't stop. So that was it for me, writing from there.
Fantastic. So I've noticed in your books, you seem to like to explore sort of major events and issues in people's everyday lives. You have dementia and the things we keep, and postpartum depression and the family next door, cancer. What sort of inspires you to deal with those significant changes in people's lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. I never set out to write about women's health, which seems to be the kind of niche that I found myself in. In fact, it was someone that said to me after, I think it was the second or the third book, oh, you write about women's health. And I said, oh, in fact, I do. So it wasn't conscious. I think health, and especially women's health, I think, A, it's underrepresented in fiction. I also think that it lends itself really well to fiction because there is the natural drama, there's the high stakes, there's the life and death. There is that ability for people to learn something whilst not being told it in a non-fiction sense. You know, I really enjoy it when people say, I learned a lot about Alzheimer's or I learned a lot about midwifery from reading, because that's the most fun way to learn, isn't it? Without feeling like you're learning. So it has just been something that I've landed in because obviously I'm a woman, I am a mother of two daughters, and so women's health just continues to be interesting to me.
I've also noticed that your books feature quite a number of child characters, and I wonder if the child's point of view is particularly important to you as a writer.
Yeah, there was a child's point of view in The Things We Keep, Clementine.
Yes, which I loved. I loved being Clementine.
Oh, I know. Well, it was really important for that book because that book was, there was a lot of heavy stuff, and I do tend to go to heavy places. Which is people find surprising if they know me because I'm a very happy, upbeat person and I go to these kind of dark places with my writing. But I really felt in that particular book that the levity that was added by her perspective was really important, that light and shade. And at the time I had a 7-year-old child as well, so that 7-year-old voice came to me. Although I could hear what my child said, but I couldn't hear his internal thoughts. So that part of it was still a challenge to write from a child's perspective. But yeah, I think children are so fresh and they're such a big part of my life as a mother of three that I wouldn't be surprised if they cropped up again in my books.
Yeah, I particularly liked in The Family Next Door how you had multiple families and dealing with sort of different, everybody having similar experiences but different, and then what they thought about the other family's experiences and the different, you know, points of view of the children. And I thought that you really, really did that well in that book. I enjoyed that.
Thank you.
So speaking of The Family Next Door, that was set in Australia, but some of your previous books have been set in the United States, and one of those had a British character. How do you, what's it like for you as a writer to create characters with different accents and from different cultures? And, you know, why did it take until The Family Next Door for you to actually set a story in Australia?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. My experience of life has been in different countries. I grew up in Singapore. I have lived in Australia for a lot of my life, but I've also lived in London for a number of years, and I've lived in Canada for a number of years. My husband is British. My son will tell you that he's Canadian because he was born there, in fact, to an Australian mother and a British father, but he claims Canadian. So my world is very multicultural. And so I just write things the way that I see it. You know, if people exist in the world, then they tend to exist in my books. The reason that this Family Next Door has been set in Australia was really because those first few books were set in the US. The Secrets of Midwives was set here because the US system of midwifery really lent itself best to that book. It's a little bit different over in Australia, so this felt like the right place to set the book. And then just for the consistency for readers, my editor and I decided to keep the next couple of books here in the US. But I was pretty excited to be able to bring a book home. And I really think that American readers would like to hear about Australia. My books are pretty universal, so there's nothing that's going to be shocking or different about a book set in Australia. But it's meant for me that I've been able to really breathe those smells and touches and all of the things that are around me into this book, so it feels a lot richer for it.
Great. So what is it like to have your novels performed as audiobooks? Do you listen to them when they come out afterwards?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's amazing. It's just another level of amazing, because every step, you know, to even get a book published is so exciting and something that you don't expect. And then to have it published as an audiobook and to get that link that I get to be able to listen to it. And there is that heart-stopping moment when you think, gosh, I hope they've got it right. You know, I hope
that, we hope so too.
Barry's nodding. And it's always just been so spot on. So it's been amazing to just hear my books be spoken and, you know, hear the dialogue be spoken, because that's what's meant to happen with dialogue, isn't it?
And when you're writing the dialogue, do you have voices in mind? And if so, when you then hear what I or another narrator have done, do you think, oh, that's really spot on, or, oh, that's not really exactly what I had in mind, or?
Both. You know, sometimes it's not what I had in mind, but it's better. Often that is the case. It's similar to when you see a book made into a film and then you see the characters that have been cast and you think, oh, that's not who I would have picked. But they're great and they're perfect. So I have had both, yeah, this is a bit different, but great. And I've had, yes, this is exactly what I pictured. And both have been great. Lucky me.
With The Family Next Door was sort of the first time that I actually, because it was the first full book that I did in Australian, entirely in Australian, I picked different actors and assigned them to different roles. That a lot of narrators I know generally work that way. This was the first time I sort of tried it out.
Okay.
So, let's see, I had Judy Davis playing Barbara.
Oh, yes.
And Kate Blanchett was my narrator voice, because she has a very sort of light accent. I wanted it to be pretty neutral.
Yes.
I listened to Toni Collette, and Ben, I think, was Hugh Jackman, and Ben Mendelsohn was in there somewhere, Nicole Kidman. So that was sort of funny. I had my little cast in my head of your book.
I love that. Who was Nicole Kidman?
I think I used Nicole Kidman for Essie.
Oh, yeah, perfect. Very good.
Thank you.
You could be a casting person.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself other than your own? And if so, what kinds of books do you like to listen to?
Yes, I do. And it was new to me. I started listening to them when I was pregnant, which was actually the same time as I was writing The Family Next Door. And I found that I just was not able to read at night. I just wanted to sleep. And so I would lie down with my eyes closed and I would listen to a book. And I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, because being a writer, I love the written word. I love to see the way words look together, and I love to kind of go back and see what authors have done. So I always have got that part of my mind, you know, editor's mind looking. And yet an audiobook is just so beautiful, and it's a different way to experience storytelling, and it still is storytelling. You know, some people think that it might be you know, like watching a TV show, which is different. I think the reading of an audiobook, it was a book, it still told you in that way. It added to my reading experience rather than took away. And I've listened to many, many books. One of my favourites was a man called, I think it's Uwe. I think that's the pronunciation, or that's how the woman pronounced it. It was a woman as well who did the voice of Uwe, and she just did such a magnificent job. But that's just one of many audiobooks that I've listened to and loved. It's a great way of reading. Yeah.
Something I particularly like about your books is how vivid the characters are. They're really easy to identify with and easy to kind of get a bead on. And dialogue is my favorite part of doing audiobooks, because it's like acting. It's like creating an entire world with your voice and having a whole cast of characters with just your voice. And I do find in all of the books of yours that I have done that your characters are so just instantly sort of identifiable. You know, I'll think, oh, I know who that is. I know what she sounds like. Now, can I make her sound the way I want it? You know, but I really, really appreciate that about your writing in particular.
Well, you do a great job with it. It's very easy to tell as well when you listen that you, I never wondered, you know, who was speaking, even though I know as the writer.
Well.
I don't always know, and I could tell because of the way that you delivered it. It was amazing.
Thank you. Can you talk to us about your next book? I understand it's called The Mother-in-Law, and it has some murder mystery elements. That sounds very intriguing.
Yes, it's called The Mother-in-Law. That's the current working title.
Okay.
I think it's a good one. I'm going to fight to keep this title because every time I've talked about it, I've been doing a little tour around Australia, and now I'm here. I always get a bit of an ooh from the audience, mm-hmm. which is really cool. I think mother-in-laws are so... it's such a fraught relationship, and for every mother-in-law unicorn, which is, you know, someone who gets along with their mother-in-law, there are 10, you know, terrible stories about mother-in-laws. And I think it's so interesting because it's not possible that every mother-in-law or even 9 out of 10 is a terrible person. It's obviously something to do with this relationship and the dynamic of it that creates this tension. And so I was so interested to explore that in a book, and I pretty much started, so there's no spoilers here, I pretty much started with the idea that a mother-in-law had been murdered, and there was a cast of people, including the daughter-in-law, who potentially did it. And it, like all of my books, goes back and really takes apart all of the relationships in the family and looks at where things were going wrong and where they were going right as well. Yeah, so it's just a bit of an exploration into particularly that mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship, but also the entire family dynamic as well.
That sounds very exciting. I look forward to potentially reading it.
Yeah. Narrating it.
Now, does the inspiration for your books come primarily from your own life or from stories that you see in the media or from other sources or a combination?
A combination, yeah. I certainly, the Secrets of Midwives came from my own pregnancy. That was my second pregnancy, where I had read all the books about what to expect when I was expecting and all of those kind of books the first time I'd been pregnant. And so this time I was reading about fiction. I was reading Call the Midwife and all of those fabulous books. And I always try and write the kind of book that I would like to read. And in that case, I was just wanting to read about midwifery. So I thought, yep, I'm going to write this book about midwifery. The next two, The Things We Keep and The Mother's Promise, were both inspired by a real life, a news article and a TV segment that I saw in those cases that were the spark or the little kernel of an idea that I then grew into a story, which was fictional, but it was just a little spark that came from the news. And for The Family Next Door, it was again about me sitting down and thinking, what kind of book do I want to read? And for me, I'm going to make a confession here. I'm a really nosy neighbour. I'm the one that stands at the window and keeps an eye on what everyone's up to. And if I notice a strange car in the street, I'm, you know, asking people who it is and if the man across the road's got a new girlfriend or something. And so I really liked the idea that people maybe were doing something that everyone's life looks perfect, particularly around the area that I live. But what if it isn't? And what if, you know, the man across the road is wheeling his rubbish bin in and there's a dead body in it, you know? Or what if that woman who's always in active wear and looks like she's got a fabulous life, in fact, has got a terrible situation at home? So it was really just my way to explore what was going on behind the fences. Because here in Australia, I don't know if it's the same, we all have fences, you know, sort of keeping people out. And so I just wanted to kind of get behind those fences. And you'll find as well that there is that women's health part of it as well, which I can't seem to get away from because I didn't intend that to be the case, but I was pregnant, obviously, you know, postpartum mood disorders, which is what this book explores, was on my mind. So that found its way into this book as well.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Sally Hepworth. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you too.
And
thank
I love you. Narrating your books. I look forward to more.
I've loved you narrating my books.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this Macmillan audio production. Please keep listening to hear an excerpt from Sally Hepworth's The Good Sister.
Most days at work, I break for lunch for half an hour, during which time I eat a honey sandwich and a muesli bar at my desk in an attempt to eschew lunchtime conversation with my colleagues. It rarely works. But Fridays are different. On Friday lunchtimes, most of my colleagues at the library go down to the Brighton Hotel for lunch. Today, among the group are Gail, Linda, Bernadette, and Trevor. The social ones. One of us is required to stay back to hold the fort, and week after week I happily oblige. I enjoy the peace and quiet. Still, I've come to enjoy the ritual of being asked, followed by the quick, unoffended no worries that precedes my colleagues vacating the building. All seems to be going to plan today. I offer my usual no thank you, but instead of replying no worries, Carmel says, "You might enjoy it if you came along, Fern." Carmel is my boss. With a thin, stern face, she resembles a humourless boarding mistress from an old English novel. She has coffee breath and whiskers on her chin, and spends most of her shifts pushing her cart around, huffing at people who ask for a recommendation. Carmel says our job is to stack books and help people with the photocopiers. "Libraries aren't just about books," Carmel said to me once, and I laughed out loud. At least, unlike boarding school mistresses, she has a sense of humour. My old boss, Janet, had a round, smiling face and an enormous bosom, and resembled a kindly matron looking after soldiers in a post-war infirmary. Janet had read every book in the library and told staff that our job was to be a front-line soldier in the war against illiteracy and lack of imagination. I told Carmel this once, and she frowned at me as if she was trying to work out a complicated maths puzzle. "Fern," Carmel prompts, "would you look at me, please?" I keep my eyes on my computer and start typing quickly, as if I'm doing something so urgent I can't possibly be interrupted, not even to respond to Carmel. This technique is successful about 50% of the time. Not great odds, but I do find it cathartic, bashing at the keyboard, filling up the silence and expectation hovering over me. The silence stretches on until Gail comes to my rescue.
"Right. We don't want to miss our booking, do we? Linda, grab Carmel's bag."
I keep typing. In my peripheral vision, I see that Carmel keeps watching me for several seconds, but then, mercifully, Gail sweeps her up in the flurry of people exiting and she is gone. It is quiet in the library for the next hour, leaving me with some free time to do some research on the computer. I am an avid book enthusiast, but even I can admit that when it comes to research, you'd be hard-pressed to find a tool more useful than the internet. It's been 3 days since Rose confided in me about her fertility issues, and 12 hours since she boarded a plane for London. I've used that time to conduct a thorough investigation into what is involved in having a baby for your sister. As it turns out, there are numerous options available. You can be a surrogate, which means you use your own egg, or you can be a gestational carrier, which means you are implanted with an embryo conceived using a donor egg. If you are using your own egg, you can become pregnant using artificial insemination, where the sperm of the intended father is inserted into your body, or you can use in vitro fertilization, where the pre-fertilized egg is implanted. In some cases, the surrogate has sexual intercourse with the intended sperm donor, but this is exceedingly rare, which is an enormous relief. As fond as I am of Owen, and as much as he'd likely prefer his own sperm to be used, the idea of having intercourse with him is startlingly unappealing. After thinking long and hard and making a spreadsheet of the pros and cons of each option, I conclude that the simplest way to have Rose's baby would be to become pregnant naturally by a man who isn't Owen. This method would have no prohibitive costs, no medical treatment, no need for Rose or Owen to be involved at all. In fact, if I were to become pregnant quickly enough, I could even surprise Rose with news of my pregnancy upon her return from her trip to London. What a happy homecoming that would be. I would, of course, require a man to have intercourse with, but that shouldn't be too difficult. By all reports, men are desperate for intercourse. Apparently, they can be found at nearly every bar and club, prowling for women to have no strings attached intercourse with. Unfortunately, I don't go to bars or clubs, but surely men congregate in other places too. I am still researching when the rest of the staff return from lunch, smelling of beer and garlic and talking several decibels louder than before they left. I continue my research a little longer,
as judging by the way everyone makes themselves scarce, they aren't bothered by what I'm doing. Even Carmel and her ever-present cart are nowhere to be seen for most of the afternoon. Thus, I am knee-deep in research about an online dating app called Tinder when a patron appears at the desk. I'm having some trouble with the printer. I hold back an eye roll. 99% of front desk queries are about the printers and the photocopiers. The photocopier inquiries are the worst, as each patron is required to load up a beastly little card with coins and connect this card to their account, a process that precisely no one, including myself, knows how to do successfully. As such, I prefer not to engage with those kinds of queries. Not only do I not understand them, they bore me in a most indescribable way. Lately, whenever a patron has a query about the printers or the photocopiers, I pretend I hear someone calling me and excuse myself. I am about to do exactly that when I recognize the person's accent and perfect enunciation.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this sample from Sally Hepworth's The Good Sister, the full audiobook is available wherever audiobooks are sold.
This is Barry Krynick. We hope you've enjoyed The Mother-in-Law, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos, recorded by Tim Marchetta Wood. Text copyright 2019 by Sally Hepworth. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.